Greg, we've just had a lovely break and you've shown me your part of your collection of wonderful early Australian gardening books. And your entry to that and to collecting was through Edna Walling.
Yes, well, at the time when we lived in North Queensland, the first time I really heard about Edna Walling was when a collection of her writing was published in a reprint. And of course, subsequently, there were some of the books put together by Trisha Dixon. So that was really how I first became aware of early gardening books. This was in the 80s. And then, of course, Victor Crittenden published a bibliography of Australian gardening books, which provided a reference point for that. But, of course, garden books, they're like hen's teeth. They're very hard to find, and they often end their life in the garden shed. And then you have things like the floods in Queensland in the 1890s. Many factors have contributed to their rarity. They're much rarer than, books that people collect in other areas, such as, travel books, early Australian explorers. Many of the books in my collection I've only ever seen once in 30 years. And they very rarely become available, but they're often, perhaps often even thrown out because they're not particularly very big, not in particularly good condition. That was, I guess, an appendage to my interest in gardening generally, but also just an interest and fascination in what people wrote in those times.
Why? What about Walling was it that particularly caught your eye?
Well, I guess it's her style. It's a very conversational, warm, encouraging style of writing. Short little pieces that are entertaining, but provide information as well. And, of course, her wonderful photography. And I've always been interested in photography as well. Her early books were published in sort of sepia tones, which I guess add to their beauty, and obviously they were published with great care.
Edna Walling is particularly known for her walling and her paving. Were any of those elements part of her writing, part of what you wanted to reproduce?
I think so, yes. We lived in the government house in Mareeba. It was a brand new government house, and I made a random stone paving in the entrance area under the house where there was bare earth. When we moved to Brisbane in the mid-80s, the year of Expo 1988, I created a circular path in the front garden made with random pieces of sandstone. I'm pleased to say the path's still there. So that was an inspiration, but I think her cottage style, her style of, having lots of green, green is a colour too, but also her style of having successional flowering, all of those things appeal to me.
And what do you then proceed to collect?
Well, I guess with Australian gardening books, you're really, and using something like Crittenden as a reference, you're collecting what comes your way because they are quite rare. When I moved to Brisbane in 86, I used to go to the University of Queensland Alumni Book Fair, which was held around Anzac Day every second year. At that time I was lucky to obtain some early editions of Edna Walling's books. I would go to the Lifeline book sales in Brisbane and then Canberra. Occasionally you would see early gardening books, but also some of the many book dealers in Australia. And of course, once we had the internet, it was more easily possible to be aware of what they were selling. So I didn't, you know, I set out, I guess, to try and get as many of the books in Crittenden's bibliography as I could. He only went up to 1950, and that was being my focus. And that also then led on to me subsequently preparing a series of talks for the Garden History Society.
What prompted those talks?
I guess it was a conversation I had with the then chair of our local branch. I joined the Garden History Society in 2010, even though I'd known about it and been interested in it for many years, but I joined because I wanted to go to the conference which was to be held in 2011 in Maryborough, my hometown. And it was in one of those early garden history conferences, I happened to sit next to Louise Moran, who was the chair at the time, and we talked about garden books, and it went from there. Of course, you had the wonderful publications of Richard Aitken, which also illustrate and talk and describe many of the publications and writings, and that's also been an inspiration. And of course, we have the Oxford Companion to Australian Gardens, which he led the production of, and that's also been an important reference.
I noted that two of the people who you particularly referenced in the collection of books that the branch digitised, the Handbook of Australian Horticulture by James and the Flora Australasica by Sweet. We'll just pause there. They're both those men are referenced in the companion, and they're particular favourites, I think, of yours.
Well, they are favourites, I guess, because the one by James is perhaps the biggest and the largest of the publications from that period, 19th century, but it also has some intriguing and wonderful illustrations, you know, which adds to its charm. And of course, the Flora Australasica by Sweet was a 19th century British publication, but Sweet was one of the very early cultivators of Australian plants. But it also has beautiful illustrations by Smith. And it's perhaps the illustrations that, you know, add to its beauty. But the writing in that one is quite clear and simple, and was even at that time some useful information about how to actually grow Australian plants.
You're looking at the book on the table. Which one is this?
The one on the table is by James, and the copy I have is one that was formerly owned by Victor Crittenden.
How did you come by that?
I bought that from the bookseller in Berkelow, who are at Berrima.
Is that?
And I think that they may have bought it at auction, I don't know.
Because Victor had his own collection too. He donated many of those, but collected again.
Yes, Victor donated, when he died, he bequeathed his collection of gardening books to the University of Canberra, and because he was formerly the librarian at the University of Canberra, which is where he was able to begin his work on the bibliography as a librarian. That was part of his job, to work on bibliographies, and you know, he had the resources, the time and the opportunity to both collect and document publications related to gardening.
I mean, this is a big, broad question about the society, but many of the society is made up of many themes and threads and people who've done that formal work. bringing publications to the public, and people who help on plant stalls on weekends. So there's a great diversity. Is that your experience of the society?
Yeah, it is. And of course, the society aims to meet that broad interest through their program each year. You know, they will have a series of talks during winter. They will have garden visits, both urban gardens or walks through suburbs. They also have projects that address certain issues. In my time, they've supported the digitisation of the records of the Yarra Lum Nursery. We had then a larger project on digitisation of some of the early Australian garden publications in the National Library. That was one of our projects in celebrating the 40th year of the Society.
You were very involved in that.
Yes, I was, because I guess of my knowledge of Australian gardening books and having some familiarity with what was held in the library, we were able to produce an initial list of books that would be good to digitise. We omitted some of the books that have been digitised in other places that are available online. We were fortunate also to have the connections in the library, and we did also have the opportunity to look at some of them. Prior to that project, I'd given the first of my talks for the Society. It was a joint event with the Friends of the National Library, and I talked about Australian garden writing 1788 to 1887, the first century of writing, and at that event the National Library had very kindly assembled some of their books for the attendees to look at, and there was also a few of my own books were put on display. Look But Don't Touch, we looked at them, and it provided a little bit of taste to a broader audience of some of the treasures, both within the National Library but also in Australian publishing.
So do you think, just pondering as you speak, Greg, has the Society driven that interest in gardening literature at the library?
It's I guess been an interest that the Society has encouraged more recently through both the efforts of our Society and the Friends of the National Library. There has been some small publications by Marion Mahoney digitised. One of the members of the Friends of the National Library actually sponsored their digitisation. But certainly it's an area where we have been active. And of course, you know, we're very fortunate there has been in the late 19th century, early 20th century, people who set about to assemble many early Australian publications, and much of that collection is now housed in the National Library. It equals or perhaps complements that held in the Mitchell Library in Sydney.
And again, touching on the photography part of that, one of the projects that you were involved with was the photography competition, the first, I think.
It was held in 2020-2021, and it started out as an idea of what could we do during COVID. We had COVID, we couldn't have talks, we couldn't have garden visits. How could we involve, and of course we did start doing Zoom talks, but how else could we engage members? I sort of naively thought also, how could we make a whole lot of money through people paying to enter a competition? But in the event, not so many people entered. Also, we extended over 2 years, perhaps because of COVID. But it was still a fun thing to do. Those people who were involved enjoyed participating, and we were lucky also to have some very eminent people who willingly agreed to be judges in the competition. That was Tricia Dixon, Lucy Cullerton, the artist, and two photographers, Victoria Cooper and Doug Spout. Between them, they judged the various categories, and although the entry number was small, we still had some splendid photos produced and award prizes.
Tell me one in particular about the lawnmower.
Yes, the lawnmower. It was by Maggie McCready, and she lives in Jindabyne, and it was just one of those magic shots that she took of her grandson mowing the lawn. And at the point where the photograph was taken, he was mid-air pushing the mower, and it captures the joy of the moment, but also in the text that was written with it, a little bit of the challenges of mowing and gardening. Maggie's no longer young, and she was both appreciative of the support her grandson gives from time to time, but also she's a very keen gardener and Instagrammer, recording the times and treasures of her garden.
I think the photography event I was thinking about this year was the film, a different kind of photography. It's your first film night, the Society's first film night.
The first film day. Yes, that's right. We had, I think we've now had two or three film days. We do them each year. The first film day we did, and we do them in the Gundaroo Hall, which is not so far the drive. It's a nice old-fashioned hall. And in the first event, we did a fundraiser. Many members had donated their gardening books, and we had a gardening book sale, and we had a film, and we had afternoon tea. Because as we get older, people often begin downsizing, so there was quite a number of books accumulated. We've been less keen to do book sales since because of the challenges of storing all of the books in advance. But this year we had a similar event. We had the lunch catered by a local Gundaroo group, fundraising for themselves, and we had a film and a lunch in the hall. We had a little bit of a talk. The theme was heritage roses this time, film related to that as well. And it's not exactly so warm in Canberra in winter. And so coming to a day event, sunny day happened to be, was something that people enjoyed. We even have members come down from the Southern Highlands for these days.
That's one of the challenges for any group, to keep people engaged, to provide events and continue to raise money and continue to exist. So is that... examining of the entrails, something the Society is doing?
Well, we're fortunate we have a fairly active and a largest group of members here, but of course, we, in addition to keeping members entertained, we like to and want to support some projects, and so the money we raise from our events helps support some of those projects. I've mentioned the digitisation of the records of the Yarra Lumla Library, each year or 2 years we will try to support some activity related to garden history. In the past, in earlier times, there was a series of booklets produced about historic gardens in the area. We also will prepare and support submissions relating to public matters relating to gardens and garden conservation within the ACT.
Part of its advocacy.
Yes.
One of the other big events of scholarship for the Society is the conference, and you were part of the program committee for the conference that the branch held in 2016. I know you weren't here for that first day, but there must have been a lot of work in planning for that.
There was a lot of work, but of course it's often the working together that makes being in any society enjoyable. We have, and we're fortunate to have, some very capable members locally, members who've experienced and organised even conferences earlier in Canberra for Garden History Society. Who're very knowledgeable about garden visits as well. My main roles in that particular activity was to be one of the members of the scientific program, but also I was a bus captain on the bus tours that we did. We had our tour into the country, out into the Braidwood area, which has some wonderful historic gardens, we had some visits to gardens that are closer as well.
And the program itself had a very scientific bent.
Yes, that's right. I think it was called something like The Science of the Garden. And being Canberra, there were people who had the strong science background that delivered a nicely tailored and integrated series of talks related to science in the garden.
I attended that conference, and one particular stood out for me was The Kangaroo Grass Makes for Wetter Landscapes by John Passiora, am I pronouncing him correctly, which was very scientifically based, but a wonderful program. It must have grieved you somewhat to not make it back for that first day.
Yes, I had some other travel commitment, and so I didn't arrive back until the morning of the next day, and I was able to attend the rest of the program, but not that particular talk.
There was a great spirit to the conference. So a big effort required on a voluntary basis. I'm not sure how long those that voluntary capacity can keep going. But one of the other people who you also spoke of and were very generous in helping me when I interviewed him was Cedric Bryant.
Yes, that's right. Well, Cedric, of course, has had a long... he's passed away now, but he's had a very long involvement with gardens and gardening in the ACT region. He came to Australia as a young man, and of course we already have recorded his history, oral history. But I got to know Cedric when he was writing for one of our free newspapers. But previously he wrote for the Canberra Times. And he was also a very long-time and strong member of our Horticulture Society of Canberra. The Horticulture Society of Canberra was established in 1929, so, you know, in the blink of an eye, it will be celebrating its centenary. And I did speak to one of the Garden History Society members just this week when she was talking at another meeting, and she noted that 1927 will be the centenary of opening of Old Parliament House in Canberra, and suggesting that perhaps that would be a good year for the Garden History Society to have a conference here again.
How was that idea received?
It was just a conversation between her and me.
Now it's out there in the ether. Your own writing, you had those, you've made those four programs where you've spoken about writing across the centuries, and you're very much into social media, which I'd like to talk about later, but is there any thought about turning those presentations into a publication?
Yes, I've thought about that. You know, it's a book in waiting, perhaps, But I very much enjoyed when I was preparing those talks and also producing the PowerPoint images. You know, each image tried to be a one-page compilation of the author and their publications. And often I would also try and have one quote from that particular author. It was great fun to do. In the first talk, I also talked about the ways in which garden writing and communication occurred, starting with newspapers.
It had that lovely title by Quill and Spade, that the word quill is barely used anymore. Did you think it would continue to fall when you were doing the first one?
I guess I hadn't thought that far ahead, but once we got into the second one, it became a logical idea to take it through to beyond the present. What would the future be?
And, of course, in the meantime, COVID struck, and you refer to your friends overseas watching and welcoming them on your more recent one, which had that lovely title, reflecting the times in which we were, the calamities of the times, a year of calamities. But and refuge, is a garden a refuge for you?
I think so, yes, because that was really talking about 2020 when we had COVID, but we started that year with the bushfires to the east, which caused Canberra to be inundated by the smoke from the bushfires. And the smoke levels were so bad that we couldn't even go outside. We had to run the air conditioning in our house virtually from December through till February. All the windows closed. We had wet towels under the doors to keep the smoke out. And so when COVID came along, you know, although we had many restrictions, at least we could go outside. At least Bunnings was open. Here in Canberra, we were lucky and we could get plants by mail order. They were considered to be essential.
You've attended other conferences since the Maryborough Conference. Do you go every year?
I've been to many of the conferences. There's a couple I have missed. I missed the one to New Zealand, and I think I had some other commitment at the time, and I missed the conference this year because it was very close to the 50th anniversary reunion of my university here, and I was going to that instead.
And do you go on the post-conference or pre-conference tours?
I don't go on those, no. I do go on the additional day where we would go and visit gardens.
And I see on your Instagram account that you went to the Australian Garden Landscape, Australian Landscape Conference?
Yes, the Australian Landscape Conferences, which are held in Melbourne every second year, and the most recent couple of those have been organised by Fleur Flannery under her company name. I think it's Outlandish, but they've always been a wonderful grouping of speakers. There's also usually a one-day garden tour, because they're held at the convention centre in Melbourne, there's capacity to hold more people than is sometimes possible with our conferences. And international gardening and landscaping experts spend some time talking to us.
It must be a giddy immersion to be in that environment for that time.
It is, but it's usually well-paced. And, you know, I'm a great believer in only going if you feel like it, that you also need to, if you feel like, you know, going and doing something else for half a day, you do that.
You also had your, just making a tangential leap, to your International Plant Pathology Society conference in August in France. You made a very swift visit there. Could you tell me about that trip?
Well, I've been involved in the executive of the International Society for 17 years, first Secretary General and then President and past President. And the congresses are held every 5 years. And most recently, the congress was held in Lyon, France. It was organised, I guess, with considerable worry by the locals because they were doing their preliminary planning during the COVID times. We weren't sure how many people would come. In the end, we had, I think, 2,400 people attended. It was 5 days of presentations relating to plant pathology with many concurrent sessions. It coincided, unfortunately, with the heat wave in Lyon. One day it was 40 degrees, the highest temperature recorded in Lyon. We had our conference dinner in a large tent where we had a performance a little bit like Cirque du Soleil, and the temperature at our table was 37 degrees.
We're accustomed to those fluctuations in Australia, but they're not so prepared in Europe.
And they don't have air conditioning often, so it can be doubly challenging, hot weather and no air conditioning. We've become very soft.
Were you part of the program organising for that?
As a member of the executive, I had lots of roles, including, you know, providing advice about the scientific program. And I, with some colleagues in Italy, organised a session on social media. We conducted a survey through our membership because the International Society involves 60 national and regional societies representing about 26,000 plant pathologists worldwide. We had about 800 people respond to our survey. We reported on the use of social media by plant pathologists. And we had some talks relating to other aspects of social media as well.
I watched your presentation and some of the comments in your survey were, I don't have time for this, but other people were engaged, and it's clearly part of the future, it seems.
Yes, I think it was useful to understand that at present time, perhaps half the our community of plant pathologists use social media, about half don't. And so in trying to outreach to a community, you need to be reaching out to both groups. You need to have strategies that are appropriate to each of those groups.
And there's a role for educating people in the way of using social media as well.
Yes, I think that's correct. But also, there can be a lot of fear about social media, and my own feelings about social media is that I'm in control of what social media I look at. And so the many elements of social media that are not so nice, I'm not privy to them because I choose not to engage or follow those people or those issues within social media.
And just as a tangent to the conference, your own social, you have your own Instagram account. And what's the name of that?
My social media Instagram account is called Garden Review, R-E-V-U-E, as opposed to R-E-V-I-U-W, because I took it along with the idea of a review, as in, you know, a compilation of things.
And from my own small engagement with it, you concentrate on plants in your garden, plants you see in conferences, and there's nothing about your family except those that have gone before, your parents and your grandparents, and that lovely photo of yourself, the little boy with a koala. Is that...
I guess I see for myself, I see my Instagram and social media as my own record. You know, it's a visual diary. I'm perhaps the only person to look back over, you know, 5-8 years of posts, I find it useful to think, now, what is that plant called, to look back and find out what it is or what the history of that plant was, you know, so that it reaches outwards to people who are interested in gardening particularly. And so I guess the posts are relating to my family really relate to issues that are memorable to me and perhaps maybe of memorable to them, those members of my family. And of course, because I'm interested in photography, that's the other aspect of Instagram that I like.
Is all your photography on the phone?
These days, yes. I do have two digital cameras, but the quality of the phone camera is so good now that it's seldom needed, although at the moment I'm lucky to have a Gymea lily flowering in the garden, and I do wish that my camera phone was a little bit better at magnifying to get a little bit more of a close-up of that flower.
When I watched I laughed out loud watching your presentation, and I'll refer to it in the transcript. We put a link there, but you had people engaged differently. It must give you some grief that the people laughed and were engaged with your curtains that you had very lushly opening and closing your presentation. That created much amusement. And your shirt, which someone wanted to suggest that you auction off. Tell me about those for the tape.
Well, you know, it happens that the PowerPoint, the modern PowerPoint versions, one of the slide changing options is curtains opening, as would have been in the past with a theatre performance, and I found it's a very good option to choose when you're starting a talk, because it does attract people's attention and makes them realise we are now starting the event, and it does you know, usually lead to some laughter. The shirt you're referring to, because within some parts of the garden history community there's interest in the shirts that I wear, but this particular shirt happened to feature the logos of many of the social media companies, and so I'd chosen to wear that shirt because of the theme of my session on social media. And somebody asked where I got the shirt from, and I joked perhaps I could auction it. And the reason why I said that is because I've also been involved with the society in establishing the resilience bursary to help plant pathologists in need, particularly in response and result of the invasion of Ukraine. And at the Congress in Lyon, we also had a session on war and conflict and plant pathology. And one of the speakers in that session commented that it was the first time that she had seen and heard this topic spoken about. She spoke about the challenges of saving the seed collection during the invasion of Syria. She was responsible for the seed collection in Syria, and she had to creep back into her sister's home to rescue some of that collection. We had a speaker from Ukraine who talked about the destruction of germplasm collection and research facilities for horticulture in Ukraine. That talk is also available online.
And the scholarship supports those people ongoing?
We had, fortunately, the strong support of the Polish Phytopathology Society. They had existing collaborations with Ukraine because they're neighbours before the war. And when the war started, some of the female scientists fled to Poland to escape the conflicts. Also, some men who had various reasons for leaving, such as disabled children. Some of the regional and national societies have helped support that fund. Usually the funding will only be for 2 or 3 months because that's all that our funds will allow for, but often also those individuals who get support will go on to get support from some other body. In some cases, they've also returned to Ukraine. Some cases, some of them had to return because they would lose their jobs if they didn't go back. But it provides them some respite. And it also means that each of them who is doing some important work relating to managing diseases is able to continue contributing to the efforts to reduce food and forest damage from disease.
And so often philanthropy begets philanthropy, and you had your 70th birthday last year, and what was your proposal for that?
Well, so for my 70th birthday, I just chose, rather than having a grand party with lots of friends, I proposed to do a fundraiser for the bursary, and quite a number of people contributed some donations, which helped boost the funds for that scholarship. We've gone on also since the earthquakes devastating Turkey and Syria to begin exploring support for people who were plant pathologists who were affected by the earthquake. So far we are providing some short-term scholarships for two postgraduate students from Turkey.
In the coverage of those wars and catastrophes, does plant pathology get mentioned in the London Times or the New York Times?
I don't think it gets mentioned specifically, but of course war is, you know, something that affects the research progress, but it also can cause things such as damage to stored grain, and of course you then have problems with fungal decay of the grain and also contamination of the grain by the mycotoxins, which are toxins produced by some fungi. But of course historically both plant pathologists and entomologists have been involved in past conflicts. For example, during the Second World War, plant pathologists and entomologists from Australia served in Papua New Guinea, and they were mainly involved in the malaria management campaign. And the first director of plant pathology, Jack Simmons, was the head of that group. And my former boss was also involved in the malaria control campaign in Papua New Guinea.
Greg, at the conference, before we just come to a couple of other aspects about plant pathology, someone made the comment that you are not only the past president, but you're the past president. How many pasts, how much alliteration can you have for that? And they made you a fellow of the organisation. How was that for you?
I guess it's becoming a fellow of society is an honour and a privilege, because it's recognising your contributions to the science of that discipline, but also the functioning of the society. But I believe it's also a responsibility, because as a fellow you should try to continue to serve that profession in ways that you can. I remember I went to a conference once and someone, one of the keynote speakers, said he used to be a plant pathologist, and I thought a medical doctor would never say they used to be a doctor. You know, they're a doctor for life, and I think in many professions we retain that interest and responsibility for our entire lives. I'm not going to stop looking at powdery mildew and knowing what it is or, you know, whatever.
And is there an opportunity within the society for you to mentor, perhaps formally or informally?
I think both through the society, but also through my involvement in the Australian Centre of International Agricultural Research, I've been involved in various aspects of training, particularly in running workshops on mango diseases, but I also did work with what was formerly AusAid, the Australian Agency for International Development, working with colleagues in ASEAN in mango disease surveying. And through that work, I had the opportunity also to travel to Myanmar, for example, a couple of times, where we would be. And of course, in, you know, while in many countries professions are dominated by men, it happens that in some Asian countries, many of the professionals are women. So most of the plant pathologists in Myanmar are women. Many of the plant pathologists in the Philippines are women. It's always a privilege to work with people, to connect with them, you know, to work together to increase your understanding of the science. But I think that there's a friendship there that, that sort of continues and underpins all of that training that we provide. Whether that's mentoring, I don't know, but it's about inspiring to continue.
You had three lovely phrases that you said came from your work. Food for thought, food for heart.
So within ACR, the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, one of the phrases from those earliest times was food from thought, recognising that the food that we eat, you know, partly is there because of the thought, the research that has underpinned its production to meet those targets of global poverty reducing. The philosophy of ACR had been doing well by doing good, you know, initiative of the Fraser government. It recognised that if we were going to be involved in international agriculture, we wanted to do well, we wanted to do good, but we also wanted to be supporting Australian farmers as well as the partners in other countries, because the people in other countries are also our customers for many of the products we produce. And food from the heart, I guess, comes out of that because, you know, there is a friendship, there is a commitment that comes from, you know, what would be the connections of the heart that occur, you know, in that sort of...
You're speaking as a as someone representing.
I think when you're involved in international development, working in partner countries, when it is government to government, you have to always remember that you are representing your country and the government, and that your behaviour should reflect that. That you're not there on holiday, you're an ambassador, I guess, unofficially for your country. You know, so it's important that your behaviour reflects that. You're not there as a tourist, and so often when you work in developing countries, people want to entertain you, and of course that's important, but it's very easy to... be too entertained. And one of my philosophies has always been, if I see everything the first time, there's no reason to go back. And so that there's opportunities to see things that you would not see otherwise, but you're there to do a job and you've always got to keep the focus on that.
I think you mentioned along the way somewhere that you gave up being a vegetarian because of your travels internationally. Was that part too hard?
I think, you know, I guess it's an awareness thing that becoming vegetarian was, I guess, a commitment to understanding both the importance of you are what you eat and diet, but also in having a lower footprint on the earth. But travelling within countries... it can create an extra challenge, and it just became easier to eat what was offered within reason.
And ACR was established in 1995 Is it still around? 85.
Oh, sorry, 1983. Yes. I started working for them in 1995.
In 83. Is it still around?
Yes. So the Australian government, so ACR was established within the portfolio of Foreign Affairs and Trade under an Act of Parliament with a 10-year sunset clause. At the end of that first 10 years in 1993, they did a review and decided, yes, it would continue. It sits outside the Department of Foreign Affairs, but it's a statutory authority. I'm not sure whether that's the current term, but they report, the CEO reports directly to the Minister for Foreign Affairs. We have a particular charter, and you know, it's ongoing in its status. It's there's a advisory body, and there's a also a body that involves representatives of different countries that will advise ACR on its activities. The current CEO is Wendy Umberger, the first woman to head the organisation.
Has it had fluctuations according to the politics of Canberra?
ACR has always enjoyed strong support from both sides of government. We have also the Crawford Fund for International Agricultural Research. The Crawford Fund, I guess, sits alongside ACR to both foster and encourage support by both government and the rural community, because it's also important that the rural community, the farmer organisations, marketing organisations, understand and value and contribute to what we do, what they do.
So what made you decide to leave the organisation?
I was appointed to ACR under a contract. The contract ended, and also at that time ACR was wanting to change direction slightly. I was working in the post-harvest area, and they decided to appoint someone who had more direct experience in horticulture. And that created an opportunity for me to move on to become a consultant and continue working in both horticulture and development.
And you did that for how many years?
I did that from 2006 up until 2019, about 12, 13 years.
And was that a natural retirement for you?
I mean, I was past my, what would be the traditional time of our parents retiring, and it was, it just it had gradually tapered off. It was fine.
And your engagement with the society picked up?
I was involved with the International Society from about 2006 when I became a consultant. Working as a consultant gave me time to, some free time to be able to be involved more in professional bodies as well, because it's all honorary work, it's not paid.
So will you have much more time now that you're a past, or will you have much, much more time that you're a past president?
I think that there's always things to do. I mean, I started this journey because of interest in gardening and family, and you know, that's going to continue.
We just had a small break and we came to your article about the Danish garden. Tell me how you came to that.
So the garden is called Sandarengard. I'm not sure whether the pronunciation is correctly, but it was a garden that was established in the 18th century, and in recent years they have tried to restore it along the lines of the original designs. And I came to visit it because the publishers of Hortus had announced plans for a garden tour to Denmark, and I wasn't able to go on the tour, but I instead wrote to some of the gardens that they were planning to visit to ask if I could visit, and the owner of Sandarengard kindly replied. It happened that she had come to Australia under a scheme for young farmers earlier in her life and had worked out at Dubbo. And so she very kindly picked up me and my wife and took me back to see their garden, and we walked around it, and afterwards I was of course interested to try to write about it to thank her, because she took the whole day and took us to two other gardens. One was a very grand garden next door and introduced me to her brother, who was the owner, and I subsequently found out that he was a count. Of course, coming from Australia, we're less aware of formalities in these matters. That garden has gone on to bigger and better things. But it's a really good example, I think, of the efforts involved in restoring a garden and maintaining the history of that connection. Obviously also connected to family. It was just a rare chance. We went there in very early spring, wasn't quite at its peak, but it was still a privilege to have that personal guided tour.
Did you catch up with the group, the Hortus group, as you travelled around, or was it quite separate?
Quite separate, and a different time. We even chose the same hotel that we planned to stay at in Copenhagen. I found in the past, in that visit we went on to England, and we had a similar experience visiting the gardens of Gertrude Jekyll. I wrote to the owners, and her gardener met us and spent maybe an hour and a half just showing my wife and I around the garden. And then she said, "Oh, would you like to go next door?" And we went next door, which was the garden that was cared for by a lady that had formerly been, her house was what had formerly been Gertrude Jekyll's potting shed. She spent, an hour or so showing us around that garden as well. Jekyll's garden has subsequently and since then been acquired by the National Trust. We in Australia don't have gardens as old. Of course, we have our history of many thousands of years of inhabitants by First Nations people, but for those with a European heritage, I guess it's always still wonderful to have chances to visit some of those gardens in Europe.
Well, Greg, I think that's a terrific point on which to conclude today's interview, and you've been very generous already with your time, so thank you very much for your contribution to the Society's Oral History Collection.